the Ed Till Show, Starcom Radio Network, AM/FM stations all across America. Very excited about this next segment. Now, our guest has been with us before. Lance Izumi is the Corrette Senior Fellow in Education Studies and the Senior Director of the Center for Education at the Pacific Research Institute. He's the author of numerous books, including his most recent title, How Do You Not Want to Read This? You got kids, you got grandkids, right? The book is called The Corrupt Classroom. Our guest has authored many studies and articles on education policy and is a regular opinion contributor to Education Week. In 2016-17, our guest served on President Trump's Transition Agency Action Team for Education Policy. Last week came out with a brand new study outlining 15 reforms that lawmakers can pursue to improve K through 12 education in America. Thank you for being on the show. First of all, I love this issue. Great to have you on again, Lance.
Well, thanks very much, Ed. It's always a real pleasure to be on the show with you.
This is so exciting. I love the title, The Corrupt Classroom, because I feel with your experience, with your expertise, with your passion for this subject, we are going to begin to get change in this area. So let me begin. Your work on the Trump Transition Agency Action Team for Education Policy must have been exciting. What can you share with us that's good news on education policy from that experience?
Well, you know, it was a really exciting experience, you know. Certainly, I think that, you know, one of the things that, you know, they had told us, you know, in the transition was that, you know, we should, you know, really be looking to really move that football down the field, you know, and not just be incremental. But I think that, you know, in terms of the specifics, you know, I can't get into the specifics because of some confidentiality agreements, but I can say that, you know, what they, what you're going to see, I am sure, from the Trump administration over the next year, a few years, is some, you know, really innovative types of proposals. I think that one of the things that we've seen already is that President Trump, early in his administration, signed an executive order asking Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, to form a review task force to look at the regulations that restrict so much good work and create so much havoc in education today, and to review those and to, you know, cut those bad ones out. And I think that you know, those results of that task force will be coming out pretty soon. So I think that's something that your listeners should you know, be aware of.
You know, you're the right person to ask this of. So I'm just going to lay it out there. I've been on the air over 40 years. So in the run-up to President Reagan's election, and you know President Trump and President Reagan have a lot in common, the proposal was to get rid of, abolish the federal education department, get it out of there. Nobody from Washington is needed in the local school. And I can't tell you how we were all excited back in 1979 and 80. And when I hear that there's going to be change under Betsy DeVos, I am excited and I support her 1,000%. But isn't that the real change that we need? Adios to Washington impacting on my grandchild in fourth grade. Isn't that really what we need?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, you hit the nail on the head, Ed. I mean, I, you know, actually worked in the Reagan administration, you know, many years ago when I was a young man. I was a speechwriter for then Attorney General Ed Meese. And yes, you know, President Reagan, you know, did make that promise to eliminate the Department of Education. Unfortunately, it didn't come to pass. But, you know, I think that there are still opportunities here to, you know, to certainly shrink the size of the department and to, you know, certainly reduce its role in interfering with the types of education decision making that should rightfully be not just done at the state or local level, but be done by parents. And so, therefore, you know, one of the recommendations I make in my new American Education Agenda is to actually have what education version of what President Reagan had, the Grace Commission, that looked at ineffective federal programs back then, and to have that type of commission today to look at ineffective federal education programs and to, you know, give the have the basis to eliminate those so that taxpayers, A, are not paying for them, but also, too, that they're not interfering in the decisions of local policymakers and parents.
You know, I so applaud you for even mentioning the Grace Commission report. I remember being on the air that day, having my copy, and getting all excited that we were going to start slashing duplication and needless government functions and personnel. So, man, I'm so glad to even hear that word brought up, because we could use a Grace Commission right now, and you'd be right on it. Let me flip this now to the other side of the equation and take advantage of another side of your expertise. If you were able to structure what a fourth, fifth, and sixth grader would be taught today, how much of what they are currently getting would you get rid of? How much would you bring back from my era? Tough geography in fifth grade, knowing Lake Titicaca, knowing all of the pronunciations around the world, foreign language words, and we had to get them right. And we didn't just circle or color in a bubble. We actually learned how to spell, and they took off for spelling if it was involved in your exam. That kind of rigorous return to basics. How would you change fourth, fifth, and sixth grade now, if you could?
Well, you know, I think that you're really onto it, Ed. I mean, that's what we really need. I mean, this is not just nostalgia that you and I might have for some, you know, golden age bygone era. This was actually, you know, looking at teaching methods that actually worked. I mean, in one of my earlier studies, you know, I looked at the types of teaching methodologies that had been employed for, you know, not just decades but even centuries, and they are actually the ones that proved effective. I mean, you know, there was a reason why you memorized your multiplication tables, so you have an automatic recall and are able to do that, and you don't, have to go through a lot of, you know, really rigmarole in order to get the right answer. Unfortunately, nowadays, and this has certainly been increasing under the new Common Core standards and curriculum that have been implemented during the Obama days and is still with us in the most states, is that what's more important is not really getting the right answers, but the process of getting to that answer, whether you end up getting to the right or wrong answer to begin with. And, you know, this has led to a lot of confusion in schools, a lot of confusion among parents. And so I really do think that we need to look at the Common Core and to see where it's confusing kids and get rid of it. And one of the top recommendation I make for state and local lawmakers is to repeal and replace Common Core. And if we're ever going to get back to those days that you and I knew, we're going to have to get rid of what right now is, I think, a real travesty, and it's reducing the performance of our kids in the classroom.
Agreed. Now, here's, I think, a tricky term for people to make sure we've got this right. We're going to always, I think, in America, love the idea of school choice. School choice sounds good instantly, but it does imply that certain schools are terrible and parents have to know the difference and pick the right one. And it kind of hits me the wrong way, because I feel, now this is just my feeling, I don't know if I can back this up with evidence, but I feel part of the social bargain is none of your schools stink. That's, you have to go on a limb with a peril of suffering if you're wrong, but that's what we're owed when we pay these big-time property taxes which fund schools. We're not able to pay in bad dollars. Our taxes can't be paid in less than standard currency. So how did we accept the uneven playing field? I know it's tough, but we're America. We can't say we can't, but we certainly haven't leveled it nice and high up there, way above medium. The level playing field ought to start at B minus and up. No, in my school, C's were frowned upon. You got a C in science, you got no smile with your report card. You were questioned about why you didn't do better. There was no just pass it. No such thing. You have to have a convincing, functional knowledge of everything in second grade, everything in third grade, everything. And you say, oh, that's so serious for them. Yes, it is. School is not for happiness, playtime, comfort, casual. There's no time for that. There's money at stake. Their future is at stake. Their parents are working hard. And for the time they're there, it changed for us in second grade. First grade, it was a little light. But once we had that cursive writing at age 7, and you were marked on spelling and penmanship from that day forward, it wasn't supposed to be fun. School was like a little kid's job. You get told what to do. It's not of our concern what you'd like to do today. That has nothing to do with it. Be grateful you're here. This is your way to succeed. So this is a hard thing to overlay on today's environment, but that did pretty well. That brought up the people that went to the moon. That brought up the society in the 70s. The growth in America was extraordinary on the globe. People couldn't believe what was happening, 60s and 70s here. Technology, breakthroughs. Now we invent websites with incorrect spelling that are narcissistic in their reinforcement of how great you are, teach nothing. You know, help me out here. I'm speaking for a lot of people my age in this listening audience. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that, you know, your observations are correct, Ed. And, what's unfortunate right now is that in many schools, I mean, they've stopped teaching cursive writing, for example. And so, you know, when you and I talk about cursive writing, some students may wonder, what is that? And so it just goes to show you know, how things have fallen in the classroom. But also, I mean, I think that one of the things that we have to, and you're right, that taxpayers who pay a lot of money into both local, state, and federal systems, you know, should expect bang for their buck. I mean, here in my own home state of California, we're paying right now around $16,000 per child, and yet California's test scores are, you know, right at the bottom. And so the question then is, how do you improve the performance of those kids? You know, you talk about the social contract. How do we improve the performance of those kids who are in the public schools? And, it's not necessarily going to be through simply hoping and crossing your fingers that government somehow gets better at spending the money. I mean, one of the things that, using my home state of California as an example, we're supposed to have so-called accountability control programs here in our state, and yet those have proven woefully ineffective that in basically relying on the schools and the school districts to self-improve. What really improves performance, if you look at the research out there, is competitive pressures. I mean, we live in a market economy where we understand that if you have competition, that not only gives consumers more choices, but it also forces those people who are producing the products to keep improving their products if they want to keep their customers. And so where you have school choice programs in play, you know, the public school systems where you have the opportunity to send your child, let's say, to a private school or some type of non-public alternative, you know, the public schools don't just stand still. They end up actually improving their performance because they can see the writing on the wall that if they don't, they're going to lose their customers, which are the children and the parents. And so therefore, you know, it's a one of those rising tide lifts all boats issues. And so, you know, I think that the a lot of times you see public school folks who are opposed choice programs, but really, you know, if they really want to improve their own systems, they should be the very ones who are supporting them.
Indeed. Now, this brings up another great question, right? A public education, the Little Red Schoolhouse, let's go back to, you know, 1880, 1890. It's easy to see how the government had to jump into this breach, because a private sector, and then private sector in education, was not developed to a level where a market could serve the need for education. I think that's obvious, right? Little Red Schoolhouse, come on, could have had three people teaching the whole town. And we get that that's quaint, and that was a function of an era. But it's hard for me to believe, in the Facebook, Twitter, everything's, you know, Snapchat era, that the market now could just push the government aside and say, just get out. You're terrible. Your track record's awful. You need to be disrupted like everything else. And in 5 years, no more public schools. Zero. Adios. Send the unions home. Send the administrators to all these public employees have to find real jobs now, because this was a temporary remedial function that is obviously, I mean, if we're doing enough silliness on the web, we could obviously be giving quality education at a much lower cost to taxpayers with much better outcomes. Can you see a day when there's no more public education and we're happy about that?
Well, I can certainly see a day when we have, you know, a lot of different choices, and you know, depending on the performance of public education, whether they're going to be still around or not. I think one of the problems you see right now, Ed, is that you know, there is, as you say, you talk about the digital revolution in society. Well, that's certainly the case in education as well. You have lots of sophisticated education software that's coming on the market that will look at where your child is performing, and, you know, gear the lessons to the exact level of your child, and the child doesn't have to be in one, you know, huge classroom where, you know, the teacher may not know that your child is having a problem for weeks or maybe months on end. And so therefore, you know, there is that disruptive innovation that is out there. And so, you know, Sal Khan, who is, many of your listeners may know as the founder of the Khan Academies, which is our online education tool, you know, has said that, you know, right now American education is following a 19th century Prussian model where all these kids are marching in lockstep. And, you know, yet you have these technological tools that are able to individualize that type of instruction for kids and really improve their performance. Mm. And so, you know, I think that it's going to be a case about, you know, who is going to take advantage of that type of technology. Will the public schools take advantage of it? If they don't, you know, certainly that technology isn't going to wait for the public schools.
Right.
That, you know, the parents are going to be able to use that either in homeschooling settings or private school settings, and eventually the public schools are going to end up suffering because they're not willing to change and not willing to innovate.
Where is the new thinking in education coming from? Are we getting enough feedback from parents? Not the complaining, you yelled at my kid, and my kid's a nice kid, and you, though that crowd has never done anything for education. All they've ever done is waste people's time on the lack of discipline that they presented to the school system. I always notice that. But I would like to hear substantive feedback and know that it was going into the mix and popping back out as an improvement. Do we have that process working well right now anywhere?
I mean, I think we do. We do have innovation that is producing results. And I think it's taking place in different arenas. I mean, I think, you know, the ability for parents to homeschool their kids, for example, you know, and using that those software online programs that I mentioned, I mean, that's, you know, opened up a huge window of opportunity for parents, you know, who are, you know, worried that, well, do I have the ability to be able to homeschool my child? Well, now, you know, there are those programs that are available that make it much easier for them. And you're seeing that, you know, played out across the country. And not just, I mean, I think people have this view that only religious people, for example, homeschool their kid, but that's not true. You know, you have that in every walk of life. I mean, here in my state, in places like the Silicon Valley, you know, you have a lot of people who are starting to homeschool their children. And so I think that there's that's happening. I think that in charter schools and some public schools, you're seeing this pushing of these new technologies into the classroom. And I mean, I visited one school, for example, in a very poor area of the Central Valley here in California, which with a lot of immigrant children who are not able to speak English oftentimes, and yet those kids are doing very well because of the ability, because that school, it's a charter school, used its flexibility as a charter school to bring in online technology that was effective with those kids.
Right.
And so, you know, only when you are able to do that, though, you know, when schools are given that flexibility to pursue methods that actually work, not those that are just fads, not those that are thought of by people, you know, in far-off Washington behind closed doors. You know, those methods that work and that parents support, are you going to get, you know, the type of change we need across the entire spectrum of education?
Lance Izumi, our guest, I want to spend some time on your latest book, The Corrupt Classroom. It's available on Amazon. You can also get it at the website for the Pacific Research Institute, which is pacificresearch.org. What do you want people to take away from the book, and why did you write it now?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things that oftentimes when we talk about the need to reform schools, reform education, you know, people like myself often only talk about test scores. And though test scores are important, they are an indicator of how well kids may be doing in core subjects. But there are a lot of other reasons why parents are trying to make decisions about whether the school they're sending their kids to is the right school for them. And oftentimes it has to do not with academics, but it has to do with things like politics in the classroom, where the classrooms are now more indoctrination centers than centers of learning, whether the child is actually physically safe. Many schools in this country have safety problems. In fact, you know, the latest federal statistics show that 750,000 crimes of violence are committed in schools every year. And also, too, I mean, many schools and school districts are mismanaged. You know, if you have fiscal mismanagement, that means that dollars that should be going to help your child are going to someplace else, often to special interest groups that are powerful in those areas. And so, you know, there are also social engineering and programs that undercut the values of parents. You know, why should parents send their child to a school that is teaching them something that, you know, they totally disagree with in terms of their own value system? So, you know, all of these issues are ones that don't necessarily involve whether the child can, you know, do arithmetic or be able to read a paragraph, but they're extremely important. I think that if you ask the parent, you know, what's important to them, they might, first thing they might say is, I want to make sure that my child comes home from school safely. And so, you know, I wrote this book, The Corrupt Classroom, to look at all these different factors and to, you know, show that, you know, each one of them are huge problems in America now. I mentioned the crime statistic. I lay out in the area of politicization, you know, example after example of classrooms across this country, red states, blue states, where bias in the classroom in favor of certain political candidates, in favor of certain political ideologies, is rampant. And I show how the fiscal mismanagement in districts, you know, from coast to coast involves not millions, but oftentimes billions of dollars. And so, you know, we have a system in place that is squandering the money that is supposed to be used for your child. And, you know, the money that they do use is often used in a way that is not only ineffective, but also, you know, undercuts the parents and their values and their beliefs.
Wow. Well, thank you for writing the book. I cannot wait to devour it myself. What would you recommend to people in the book when they start? That this is the first time they're reading about it. This is their first delve into education. What a primer, what advice would you give them? Say, when you get this book, get ready for what?
Well, I think, first of all, there are two things. First of all, I think parents should understand that they're not alone. If they're experiencing these problems, it's not just an isolated incident. And so, you know, they have to look at this not just as, you know, a family problem for them, but, you know, something that's going across school districts, across states, across the country. And so, therefore, you know, this hopefully will lead to, you know, grassroots, revulsion amongst parents, and therefore a push for change amongst their policymakers. Secondly, I think the parents need to know that what are the options that are going to help them. You know, I in the case of school safety, for example, if you're a child, and I have an example in the book that where a child has been beaten in school, suffers a terrible concussion and other injuries, and yet the school officials lie to the parent about cause of the injuries and, you know, the punishment that they were going to deal out to the perpetrator. So in response, the parent, you know, decides to homeschool that child. But what that shows is that parents need an immediate exit ticket in a situation like that. Why should you be forced because you don't have the money to be able to send your child to an unsafe school?
Right.
And so therefore, we need to give them that school choice exit ticket.
Lance Azumi, what a great half hour. It's hard to believe we just spent a half an hour. It went by so quickly. Lance has a new study that outlines 15 reforms that lawmakers can pursue to improve America's K-12 education. The book we've been discussing is called The Corrupt Classroom, and you can get that on Amazon, or you can go to the Pacific Research Institute website, www.pacificresearch.org, and get more information. You can also follow PRI's Twitter at Pacific Research. Lance, I love talking to you, and I would love to have a 4 or 5 hour segment on this one day, because we've only just begun. But I thank you so much for your hard work and dedication. Thank you for mentioning that you've been at this since the Reagan days. We need you, we appreciate you, and we look forward to having you back on the show.
It will be a great pleasure to be back on you, Ed. I look forward to that future conversation.
Same here. Lance Azumi, brilliant, motivated, and hanging in there for kids, students, parents, communities that all say, my God, we can do better in education than this, right? You bet we can. Lance Azumi, the author of The Corrupt Classroom. Find him at pacificresearch.org. Get the book. And then when we have him back, we'll invite your phone calls and texts and emails, and we'll go even deeper on this very important subject. It's the Ed Till Show, Starcom Radio Network, AM/FM stations all across America. News, weather, sports, a look at Wall Street, all coming up from your local stations.